Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Bradley Gerrard, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
Very good, John. Thank you.
Yeah, busy week this week?
Yeah, it has been. Very busy.
Lots to talk about in the news section. What are we going to talk about today?
We're going to talk about a mixture of things from 7 days, update on Sainsbury's bid for home retail.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, well, lots of other stuff.
Okay. Mark Robinson, how are you doing, Mark?
Very well, thanks, John.
And busy week for you on the oil and gas front this week. It's kind of your swan song on the oil and gas front, isn't it, as well?
Yes and no, I guess. Alex Newman will be taking over that beat.
BP results this week, Shell today, which wasn't in the magazine, and some other observations from the oil and gas industry, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the main attraction this week, Simon Thompson. How are you, Simon?
I'm very well, John.
Yes, you've made it in past the breached sea defences of Dover.
I certainly have, 3 hours later.
Wow. Yeah. Luckily, you don't do it every day anymore.
That's good for me.
Indeed. Not good for us, though. We miss the pearls of wisdom that's
dish
out in the office. But no, your pearls of wisdom are on display in this week's magazine, Bargain Shares.
It's a 10,000-word epic, John.
Was it 10? I didn't count.
I did.
I counted the pages, not the words. There was a lot of pages.
It's all quality.
Kept me busy on my commute, put it that way. We have to be very careful though, that no one's looking over my shoulder, because Bargain Shares is very hot stuff, isn't it?
It's not only hot, but I think given the companies in this year's portfolio, it could be a very good one indeed.
Okay, well, let's hope they're not famous last words. Right, let's come on to Bradley and the news. Let's start with 7 days. What's been going on?
Yeah, I guess Sainsbury's is one thing we've mentioned before in recent podcasts. They did sort of follow through with their interest in Home Retail Group. They announced last month, I think it was in January, they'd try to make a bid in November and been rebuffed, and they've obviously come back with a better price this time. They've actually got until the 23rd of February now to sort of hammer out the sort of real nitty-gritty of the deal. But yeah, it's an interesting deal. There's a lot of moving parts, obviously, because Homebase, which is owned by Home Retail Group, is going to get sold to an Australian company. And then also, there are lots of questions about what the real value is of Sainsbury's buying Argos. I mean, there's quite some sort of polar views on, yes, it's amazing because Argos has this fantastic distribution network now. It offers same-day delivery, but not for fresh foods. So,
but Sainsbury's does fresh food itself.
Yeah, it does.
It's more interested in the non-food expertise here, I guess.
One would imagine that's the case, yeah. I mean, and they have kind of been doing a little trial. I think it's in about 10 stores of having Argos sort of concession stands in Sainsbury's supermarkets. So you could argue the potential for this deal was maybe visible. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting element to Sainsbury's business, and especially for us, because Sainsbury's is a tip of the year for us. This obviously, we didn't know about the deal when we tipped it. We were already bullish on Sainsbury's compared to its peers. So yeah, this is quite interesting.
Well, looking at the tip updates, paid so far so good on the Sainsbury's front, up 2% since the start of the year. That's not a bad effort given what's been going on in the market.
It's pretty good.
That suggests that this has been generally well received.
Yeah, it would do. And also, I guess it suggests as well that Sainsbury's kind of core business is pretty sound. It's not having the trouble that Tesco is. Morrison's is pulling out of convenience. It's kind of in a little bit, dare we say it, of a sweet spot, I suppose. Again, compared to its peers, you know, it's relatively trouble-free. And if this Argos deal goes well, then who knows what that could do to the balance sheet. So,
what have the analysts been saying?
There's been a mixed reviews, I think. I mean, Harriet's been more sort of knee-deep in this than me. But as I said, when we kind of first covered it, there was a bit of confusion as to why Sainsbury's would go for Argos. But I guess the important thing is that distribution capability. And also what it will allow Sainsbury's to do is, while there's potentially a big estate portfolio, what it can probably do is get rid of some Argos stores and put some smaller concessions in its larger stores.
Yes.
So I guess from that point it makes sense.
Cause big cost savings there.
Yeah, I mean, the whole big box supermarket thing is becoming a bit outdated now. You know, people are shopping, you know, in smaller quantities more often. So these massive, massive supermarkets that the likes of Sainsbury's and Tesco's have are not obsolete, but they're becoming less popular. So I suppose if you're Sainsbury's, you've got a lot of the big supermarkets, it makes sense to kind of carve out a bit of space within those for an Argos sort of stand. And the click and collect type stuff is popular.
Okay, well, I mean, Tesco's been trying similar things. It obviously has, you know, some of its larger stores have its own, you know, sort of ancillary brands in them. So you've got things like Giraffe in there and Harrison Hall, the coffee shops.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, I guess it's perhaps a change of the wind for the supermarket sector.
I guess
kind of finding their feet after a few difficult years.
Yeah, they you know, it's no longer good enough to just be kind of a good supermarket. I guess you need another reason to pull customers in. And like you say, Tesco's, you know, there's one not far from our office which has got a burrito bar inside run by a company. I mean, I guess that sort of thing is going to be what they need to kind of pull customers in, that they need more sort of reasons to get people through the door.
Okay. We never go in the supermarket, really. We have it all delivered.
Same, yeah. I haven't stepped foot in the supermarket for ages.
There you go. Okay, what else we got going on in news?
I think another maybe sort of interesting one for our readers particularly is the focus of the FCA this week on CFD trading platforms. Mm. That's Contracts for Difference. So they are sort of financial derivatives that basically allow individual investors to trade the moving share price of stocks. So you can go long or short them. But they are leveraged, so they're potentially very risky because you can lose more than you initially put down in the investment. So the FCA has written a Dear CEO letter to the industry after doing a sample of 10 firms ranging in size that operate CFD trading platforms, and just kind of said, I suppose the simplest way to say it is that they really need to tighten up their assessment of the types of people who are using their services.
So I guess this is partly a response to the sort of plus 500 debacle that we had.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
year.
We mentioned that company in the small piece in 7 days, and they had to temporarily suspend some client accounts because the regulator wanted them to check and update, and in some cases, I think I'm correct in saying, get clients to sort of sign additional paperwork to make sure that they complied with various regulations and legislation. So, yeah, I think it's kind of a warning, I guess, to kind of CFD operators from the regulator that they need to make sure that their operations are kind of watertight in terms of what they need to do to make sure the people using them are, it should be.
Yeah, okay. So you got the money laundering thing, but also the client suitability.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is an interesting backdrop for a flotation that's coming soon, which is CMC.
Well, yeah, again, it is interesting, and I think it is becoming a bigger industry, and I guess maybe that's why the FCA sort of been looking at it more recently, because the rise of, I guess, things like pension freedoms, people getting cash out to maybe invest a bit more. I mean, you could argue CFDs would probably not be the first port of call, but perhaps the rise in the potential for there to be investments in CFDs has prompted the regulator to think, we need to make sure that if there is a trend of increasing interest in this, then we need to make sure we're on top of it.
Yeah, we wrote a feature a couple of weeks ago on how you actually short sell shares, and kind of trying to teach people how to use these things responsibly. I mean, you're not anti-CFD. I mean, there is a place for these kind of products, aren't there, Simon?
There's a place for all types of investing. Basically, if you try and stop people short selling shares, it's a bad idea. We've seen that in China, the ramifications of that. Leverage trading, it's sensible as long as you're sensible.
And you can use them to hedge risk as well.
Well, exactly. I remember back in the bear market of 2008, 2009, recommending readers of the Investors Chronicle take out a listed turbo, a CFD, in effect, with Société Générale to basically hedge their portfolios. And many readers actually wrote in later that year to say thank you because it saved them a fortune given what happened to share prices that year. So it's not just speculation, it's also hedging.
Mm. So I guess some of these people would have had large portfolios, didn't want to liquidate them. In a turbulent market, given the cost and complexity involved in doing that, buy a product that actually hedges out any potential downside. And, you know, if the market weakens, your share price, your share portfolio might lose value, but your turbo would be in the profit.
That's exactly it. And you've got to bear in mind that many people who were fortunate enough or smart enough to actually buy into equities back in 2009 will have many shares that have doubled or even trebled in value. There are big thumping capital gains on those, which if you sell them, you're going to crystallise them. HMRC will want their share of that tax take. So an easy way to actually hedge off the risk, the investment risk, is CFDs.
Okay. So, yeah, we shouldn't write these products off as mere tools for speculation.
Absolutely not.
Okay. The European Securities and Markets Authority has also had something to say this week about a subject dear to our heart, which is closet trackers, I notice.
Indeed, yeah. They've done, they've looked at some data. I mean, I was actually kind of chatting via Twitter, actually, to Ben Seeger-Scott over at Tony Best Invest, who's a research analyst over there. And he was a bit kind of sceptical about how ESMA has kind of gone about this and the data set they've chosen. But his reason was that they've only sort of really analysed about 12 1,200 funds, I think, out of a sample of 2,500 or something.
That's a fair chunk.
Yeah, it is a fair chunk, but only over about 2 years or something as well. So I guess you have to start somewhere, which is what I said to him. I mean, you know, you could argue if they'd done 5 years, somebody could say, well, why didn't you study 10 years? So, I mean, it's a start for them. And I guess what they're kind of... Well, closet tracking, as perhaps as you said, we've covered this various times before.
Perhaps we should explain what we mean.
Yeah, yeah.
By that.
So basically, it's the suggestion that there are funds that are managed by active fund managers that effectively all they're really doing is pretty much tracking the benchmark which their fund is meant to actually outperform. So,
but charging active fees.
Yeah, of course. So basically, you're sort of paying for, you know, an expensive, vigorous research, so that the fund you invest in can only buy the stocks it really thinks it should do and avoid the ones it thinks it should avoid, rather than just a tracker fund. But in some cases, ESMA seems to be suggesting actually there are quite a few instances whereby these active fund managers are really doing little more than just tracking an index virtually.
Yeah, it was something that our former personal finance editor, Moira, was very hot on. I mean, she was always on the lookout for this. Yeah. Always on the lookout for her view was that it's fairly rife, in fact.
Yeah, it is. And actually, there's a fund manager, I won't name him, although he did say it at a round table a few years ago, but he left a big fund manager, which is linked to a life company, I'll say that much, and now moved to a smaller boutique. And he was fairly open about the fact that when he was at his bigger employer, the risk controls, the compliance people there were a lot stricter. If he took too much of an active bet, he'd have someone on his shoulder saying, I think you should wheel that back a bit, kind of thing, because... They're a bit scared of they're being too wrong, maybe.
Yeah, so in fact, the compliance burden actually was forcing these funds to become closet trackers.
In a way, yeah, I think that is the case. In some instances, obviously, we don't know that's the case everywhere, but yeah, obviously, if you're paying for active management, you know, you want a fund manager who is going to really outperform and actually have conviction bets. I mean, in a way, it doesn't really matter if the manager you invest in really underperforms 1 year, as long as they're sticking to what they told you they would do, really. I mean, yeah. Like a multi-manager who buys funds would say that even if you've got a manager who's really underperformed 1 year, as long as they're sticking to what they said they would do and their convictions in what they do is sound, that's fine. But yeah, obviously you don't want to be paying a fee for that and getting an index return.
No. I mean, we put together our top 100 funds every year. You know, we think there are some great fund managers out there, despite, you know, the questions that constantly arise over the usefulness of the fund management industry. We
Absolutely.
Think there's some good funds out there.
There are.
So look at that. Go back to the website. It's always there. you can find the fund managers who are definitely not closet trackers.
Absolutely.
One last story from this page, I think, before we move on, is this nice little chart of the week that you've got here, which you wrote, didn't you?
Yeah. It was a little release from Trevor Greatham, who works at Royal London Asset Management now. He's the head of multi-asset over there. He used to work at Fidelity for quite a long time, actually, and kind of was very senior in their multi-asset division as well. And he's composed this kind of like sentiment indicator, which he basically creates himself from various signals to the market, management buying or selling, that kind of thing. He thinks that now for him is this indicator suggesting it's a pretty good time to buy European and Japanese equities in particular. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of got his sentiment indicator versus the MSCI World, which is kind of largely rising the past few years. It's dipped a little bit in most recent months, but the sentiment indicator is pretty bearish, and Trevor's view is that actually there's no need to be quite so bearish as people are being. So he's topping up on European and Japanese stocks.
Okay, well, that chimes very neatly with my editorial this week, because I've been quite gloomy since the start of the year. Understandably, the markets have been pretty grim, you know, and I tried my best to inject some optimism into my worldview this week. And I, you know, maybe I've timed it right.
Maybe you have, yeah.
Maybe
you,
I've timed
you tried
it right.
Very hard as well.
I really tried.
I can feel it radiating off the page.
I mean, Simon, you wrote a big piece, not in this week's mag, the week before, on bear market signals.
That's correct, yes.
I mean, what's your general feel of the markets before we come on to bargain shares in a minute?
I think there's probably more pain to come. The key take from that bear market signals piece I wrote was that when you have a long bull market like the one that we had between 2009-2015, and the extent of the rise in share prices, corrections, given the huge rise we've had, become deeper. And bear markets, when they happen, and of course certain indices like the DAX and the Nikkei have gone into bear markets, those bear markets are deep ones as well. So my own take at the moment is that we'll see increased volatility over the next few months, possibly even a sideways movement looking 2 months out. Ultimately, it's going to be down to the central banks as to what is offered up to placate investors as to the depth of negative sentiment. And that's over the next couple of months how I see things panning out. I can't see a collapse in share prices from this point over the next few months. We've already had the damage done. So we've had the shock to the system. You know, the FTSE 100 was down over 20% on the 20th of January from its bull market high. So people are getting over that, readjusting their expectations. We've got the earnings season coming up. Yes, we'll have some negative earnings from certain companies that are very cyclical, you know, the oil and gas industry, for example. But you'll have some positive news coming out too. So it's a battle between the bull and the bears, as I see it, over the next couple of months.
Okay. Nothing conclusive, really. No big upward moves.
Not sitting on the fence. I can't see the market rallying sharply, but I can't see severe downsides over the next few months, given we're going into the earnings season.
Yeah. That's a relief.
Good.
I mean, actually, AstraZeneca had a profit warning today, which is a bit of a surprise, but there you go. I mean, talking of oil, let's quickly turn to Mark Robinson, because you've obviously covered BP's results this week, which were absolutely horrific.
Yes, well, as expected, really. I don't think there was any they came up short of the earnings consensus, but we had been expecting the metrics to pull back. I guess the main takeaway from BP's results, and also I've just been looking at Shell today, is the fact that their reserves replacement ratio is dire at the moment. These companies have obviously cut back their OPEX costs, but also CAPEX in an effort to shore up cash flows and underpin their dividends. But over the long run, that could have serious implications for their production levels.
Okay. I mean, there's another piece you've written at the front of the magazine as well, which is more specifically about the North Sea oil fields.
Yeah, well, I was speaking to one of the analysts at Wood Mackenzie a little bit earlier on this week. It's hardly surprising that they've published this now. I was speaking to Simon about this, actually, earlier on today, the fact that many of the hedges that were in play in the North Sea have come off now. And so Wood Mackenzie have been looking at the issue of decommissioning. And they've come up with some fairly scary numbers there. They say that as many as 140 fields are at risk now over the next 5 years, even if oil returns to $85 a barrel. And there's no indication that that will happen certainly this year. And so even at a reduced rate, you could see 50 companies coming off in fairly short, or 50 fields coming off in fairly short order as well. The problem's really, the reason this is going to happen is because just obviously linked to the reduced assumptions on the oil price as well. But now it appears that as intelligence has grown, industry operators have got a much better idea now on the likely decommissioning costs. And from about 2013 onwards, the government introduced legislation which has improved the rebate system. It's not nearly as generous as it is in Norwegian waters, of course. But operators are now at least have some clarity on the associated costs. So, we could see that a trickle becoming a flood before too long.
Okay, but so there's a flip side to this, though, which is potentially this massive scale decommissioning could actually breathe a bit of life back into oil services.
Well, yes. I was speaking to a couple of the principals from Gulf Marine Services only last week, and that particular company makes floating rigs, but they've just moved in the decommissioning space as well. And from what they were telling me, they see it as one of the real growth areas in the future, not just for the North Sea as well, but other waters. And plus, they also mentioned Iran. You know, that's going to be another boon area for oil services too.
Yeah, so what we were talking about earlier was that Iran's oil production capability has essentially been underinvested for decades.
Yeah, it's been degraded over the last decade, and they're hoping to increase. Well, they're hoping to bring another half a million barrels per day onto world markets and increase that over time to maybe 3.8 to 4 million barrels a day. But it's going to take a major investment to get that up to speed. And plus, like many of the main oil-producing countries, Iran has to import a lot of finished product because it has fairly low refining capacity, and they're looking to build that up over time.
Okay. So that's it for oil, is it, Mark? Are you,
well, not quite. As I mentioned, Alex Newman will be taking over that beat next week, but I'll always have an interest.
Yeah, well, you had one last hurrah in the tip section this week.
That's
tipping
right.
Tipping an oil producer.
Yes.
You're a brave man.
Yes, well, Algy did say to include a rather hefty caveat with it, and anyone who follows the sector will know that they've got to take the price into consideration. And the company that I've looked at has obviously got a number of characteristics that we think will see it through the other end, including a fairly hefty balance sheet, and its capex requirements aren't overly onerous as well.
Okay, your new beat,
yes,
that you're picking up is support services.
Support services, yes, I'm taking them.
Yeah,
off
so your first foray into support services was a massive profit warning.
yes. Lakeland,
that's a Lakeland, retailer, yeah, of kitchenware.
I was thinking of the darts.
Lake, that's Lakeside.
Oh, well done, here we go.
Which is also a shopping centre in Essex. Lake House.
Yes, Lake House.
Well, not an auspicious start to
no,
this.
No, not at all.
To this sexy
not at all. It might be something about me, who knows. Well, the difficulty that we've seen here, and I was talking to a few analysts through the week there, is the idea of these framework contracts that they've entered into, and the fact that not all of these companies have any real clarity on the future level of revenues that these generate. It's only indicative rather than in any way. There's no real delineation there. So Lakehouse have suffered as a result.
So to who are its customers?
Well, it's housing association clients,
right,
for the most part. And again, housing associations under pressure as well through legislation coming in, which will actually effectively require that their tenants' rents, okay, will be reduced over the next 4 years. And so it's feeding into that.
Yeah, we've seen companies that support local government, local authority housing, that kind of, we've seen them run into trouble before over the years. It's a well-trodden path. Mark, things can only get better.
Exactly.
And also, another tip update of yours, which is probably worth mentioning, because it's an absolute corker. So,
yes,
from the ridiculous to the sublime,
well,
what's happened there?
Our old friend Syngenta, we've covered this company, or this group rather, in the magazine on several occasions, because it links into the long-term thematic view of people like Jim Rogers, that, you know, agriculture over the long haul is a suitable avenue for a capital. And they've actually been, they were approached last year by a state-run Chinese corporation, Chem China.
And Monsanto tried to buy them as well.
Yeah, Monsanto actually offered a slightly higher offer at the tail end of last year, but that was rejected. It was always going to be suspect, that as well, because of antitrust issues, obviously. Mm-hmm. They share a number of key markets in agriculture as well. So, I mean, that over the long term, I don't think that would have been viable anyway.
No, well, there's already worries. I mean, sort of ethical worries about Monsanto's dominance of certain areas of agriculture.
Yeah, and that actually applies to Syngenta in areas like fungicide as well. And I think they're two of the three largest proprietary seed manufacturers as well. I might be wrong there, but
that's generally the problem area that most people look at.
In a sense, it's not surprising that that China has come in for this strategic move, really, because when you look at the agricultural sector in China, it's still under mechanized, for one thing, and plus farming methodology is outdated in many instances, and plus you've got this dynamic now where a lot of following the British and European example as well, where you've got farm labourers, agricultural workers moving to the cities for higher wages, and this has led to a shortage of labour. And so the only way around this is by mechanisation and improved technology, and that's exactly what the Chinese are doing.
Okay, so you only tipped that in December?
Yeah.
And it's up 17%?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had an eye on it for years, actually, just because of that thematic angle that I mentioned earlier on.
Okay. Well, no, good stuff. Okay, while we're on the subject then of tips, let's turn to bargain shares, Simon, because it's a mammoth effort again. 17th year, isn't it?
It's the 17th year.
Wow. It's an institution.
I think so.
So, Simon, let's talk bargain shares. So, what exactly is it? I mean, what are we actually doing here?
It's actually quite simple. The portfolio is based on the writings of Benjamin Graham. He was the grandfather of value investing. He was a professor at Columbia Business School. One of his star pupils was one Warren Buffett. Berkshire Hathaway fame. He's basically renowned as the greatest value investor of all time, Warren Buffett. But this portfolio is based on the writings of Benjamin Graham, his seminal book, The Intelligent Investor, 1949, a must read for any investor. And basically what I try and do, and following the writings of this book, is look for companies out of favor because of some unsatisfactory development of a temporary nature. So I'm able to buy the assets of that company well below their true worth. I've tweaked the criteria that Benjamin Graham followed in his book. And basically what I'm looking for is to be able to buy the fixed assets of a company for nothing. I want those in the price for free. And if I can actually find companies with solid balance sheets, decent trading prospects over the long term, in time, the value of those companies will return back to their intrinsic value. And that's why this portfolio has done so well over the years.
Okay, so tell us how well it has done. I mean, it has been mostly good. I mean, there's been a couple of years where it's not really fired on all cylinders, but mostly good.
It's beaten the over 1 year term for each portfolio. It's beaten the FTSE All Share Index against which we benchmark it 14 times out of 17 years. It's produced a one-year return of over 21% on average. And how does that compare with the FTSE All Share Index? 3%. That's the average return over that 17-year period.
See, that's what we're looking for in active management, isn't it, Bradley?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, maybe there are some fund managers out there willing to read this article.
Absolutely. As we said, you know, sometimes it's not going to work. Sometimes, for whatever reason, small caps fall out of favour. It's generally small caps you look at, isn't it?
I find the value in small cap companies, simply they're under-researched, shunned sometimes by fund managers. As a result, I can actually find rich pickings in that sector.
Yeah, you know, when you've been doing your research this year, the market is obviously somewhat turbulent. How has that affected your approach this year? Have you tweaked it anyway, or do you feel it's just offered up, you know, more opportunities than there would otherwise have been?
It's not only offered up more opportunities, and what's actually interesting is that the bargain share portfolio does incredibly well either at the start of bull markets. So the 2009-2010 portfolios both produced returns of 50% plus. It also does well after periods of an increase in risk aversion. So in 2011, when we had the Greek crisis and markets were falling out of bed, well, the 2012 portfolio, early 2012, I had rich pickings in the small cap field, and that portfolio did incredibly well. And it was the same in 2013 as well. So this year, having run the scan of 1,700 fully listed companies and targeted small cap companies in particular, I've actually found an incredibly high number of value opportunities that fits my criteria, and also, realistically, I'm confident of producing a decent return for long-term investors. I have tweaked the criteria. I've only looked for cash-rich companies. So all these balance sheets, I'm not only able to buy these companies below their net asset value, but a chunk of that net asset value is cash.
Margin of safety.
It's a huge margin of safety, John.
Yeah, it's what we want. So give us a flavour of what you found this year. I think even oil and gas has made its way into your portfolio as well.
There's one company that obviously won't give the name, but its market capitalisation is £63 million. It's got £84 million of cash on its balance sheet. It's got another £45 million of cash, which will be coming shortly onto its balance sheet. So it's basically trading at half its cash level. It's also got a very valuable interest following a farm out deal in North Africa. To me, that absolutely shouts value.
Absolutely. Quite a lot of investment companies on here.
The interesting thing there is that I found cash-rich investment companies. So once I actually strip out the cash from the market capitalization of the companies, then look at the assets that are being held, the investments held by those investment companies, those investments in some cases are being attributed values as little as 20 pence in the pound.
And these are decent little portfolios of generally smaller companies. Some of them are listed smaller companies that they're investing in as well.
These companies aren't dogs. These companies have actually produced the goods year after year after year, but it's just a spike in risk aversion in the last few months that has caused these companies to fall out of favour. But to me, if you can actually buy a pound of assets for 70 pence or 60 pence, and 50 pence of those assets is already in cash, it doesn't take a genius to work out that over the long term, the outcome for your investment is probably going to be favourable.
Absolutely. So probably never a better time to have a look at bargain shares then, really.
I'm actually, in terms of this portfolio this year, at this point in time, I'm actually quite confident that these companies will do rather well.
Yeah, good. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good stuff. Right. Bradley, I'm conscious we haven't really even got through all the news. I mean, was there anything else that really struck you in the news section this week?
I guess one thing I've mentioned is the lady who's going to be the new chief executive over at M&G, which is the fund management arm of Insurer Prudential. She's currently the chief investment officer at Aberdeen. So you might think, oh, she might be pleased to be leaving Aberdeen with all its sort of travails with emerging markets and that sort of thing. But actually, M&G has its own challenges. It's obviously very well known for fixed income, and there have been a lot of outflows from fixed income. I mean, its own kind of flagship fund, Optimal Income, was 24.6 billion in size this time last year. It's now 16.2 billion. So it's still a big beast, but not as big as it was. So it'll be interesting to see how Anne does over there. I think the general consensus is that it was probably an amicable kind of split from Aberdeen. There's nothing sort of untoward. The job came up and she was a strong candidate, and it's a chance for her to lead a fund manager.
Yeah, so. this was written by Emma Powell, who's taken over that financials beat.
Yeah, she is.
A bit of a reshuffle.
It is. Yeah, we've had a reshuffle here. So she's taking over from Ian Smith. So, so that was an interesting piece. And I guess it's worth listeners checking out the new Spotlight piece as well, just to get an idea of what Google or Alphabet, as it's really known now, is.
Is it?
What
is I don't
doing.
Know what it's known as anymore. I can't keep up. Some people call it Google. Its ticker is still Google.
Yeah, it's changed its name to Alphabet. The ticker is still Google, but Alphabet is effectively, I suppose, the parent's kind of name, if you will. And then, although the Google bit is still the dominant part, but they kind of shone a bit of a light on some of their more interesting projects, I suppose.
So the moonshots, they call them.
That's what they call them.
Right. And what is this sort of stuff?
Things like driverless cars, and I think one thing is even contact lenses that tell how much, like, how your blood sugar's doing and stuff like that. I mean, really, really quite sci-fi stuff.
Yeah. Driverless cars. My children are not old enough to drive yet. And I said, they were saying, oh, Daddy, one day I'm going to get a car. And it's like, well, by the time you get to drive, girls, they're all going to be driverless. They're absolutely mortified.
Make getting a driving license a lot easier.
It certainly will, but I think they watch my wife driving and think, yeah, I'll have some of that. She's a bit of a girl racer, my wife. Okay, plenty of results in the magazine this week as well. I don't know if you picked any up, did you, Bradley?
Yeah, I don't think I did this week. It's
lazy.
It's been busy, though. I know, yeah, I just sitting around my feet up.
So we had Hargreaves Lansdown, which was interesting.
Yeah,
doing very well in terms of scooping up assets under management.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big beast in the broking world. I mean, it's not going anywhere anytime soon, that's for sure. But it's having to deal with sort of changes in the pensions landscape. But it's doing very well. I think it hit record assets under administration. So
yeah, Convivial. I thought you'd have covered Convivial. Oh, no,
not guilty. Retail, not guilty.
No, Booze. They seem to be doing okay. Ocado, not so well. Just goes to show life is just as tough online as it is in the aisles for the supermarket industry.
Absolutely.
Diageo. There you go. Yeah, I've got
guilty.
One. Diageo.
I wondered if that was this week or last.
I think it was the back end of last week and crept into this week's
it
mag.
It did, yeah. Interesting one. Again, people might favour it for its emerging markets exposure, but it's got quite a big chunk of business in Nigeria, I think, from memory. And obviously the currency in Nigeria is not doing well at all. Mm. And the country actually went to the World Bank start of this week or end of last week for the potential for some emergency loans. So it might not be the best country to have exposure to at the moment.
Well, you picked up PZ Cussons a couple of weeks back as well, which you downgraded.
Yeah.
And that's a Nigerian story as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Real big problems in that country, which I picked up on years ago when I tried to sell them. You might remember that, Simon.
I certainly
probably
do,
were around. It didn't work out so well.
No.
That tip is in the money now, eventually. Yes, never mind. As I say in my editorial, my success rate on buys was always better than sales. Selling shares is hard work. You know, shorting is a difficult business. Getting sales right is hard.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that the majority of time markets are actually in bull markets.
Yeah.
Bull markets last longer than bear markets. So to actually short shares, you're running against the tide most of the time.
Absolutely, which is one of the reasons why you should be optimistic rather than pessimistic. Glass half full rather than half empty.
Always am.
My glass is pretty much always empty. Okay, that will do for this week. We've discussed plenty there. Lots more results, actually. We've got Sky as well, as another big one. Bargain shares is obviously the main feature, but we've got John Barron this week and his investment trust portfolio. Emma Ajimang has looked at a couple of new entrants to the broking scene. So we've got the big, big old Hargreaves Lansdown at one end, but these guys that Emma's looked at this week are very interesting. A couple of companies who are offering broking at ridiculously cheap rates. And we've had readers asking us, is this kosher? Is this for real? We've met them, we've spoken to them, we've got DeHero and iDealing, and they're both doing some really interesting things in this space, using technology to really bring some disruption to broking and the amounts that brokers charge. So definitely worth a look at that article if you're interested in that. You're sacrificing service for price, potentially. Hargreaves obviously provide a lot of service. These guys will, it's a stripped down version. So definitely worth a look there. We've got to take a focus on the miserable world of mining and plenty in the personal finance and funds section, which they will be talking about on their podcast. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Simon. We will catch up again next week. Pick up the magazine, Bargain Shares, Simon Thompson's stellar picks for 2016. 4.70, all good news agents. See you soon.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.